This is local and regional news on KMUN. It's Thursday, February 19th. I'm Skylar Butenchin. Clatsop County leaders are taking another stab at a topic past leaders have circled, studied, and recommended for decades, consolidating 911 dispatch operations into a single organization. They believe the move would create a more efficient and resilient system and allow for critical updates to equipment and infrastructure. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz has more.
In Clatsop County, some emergency responders rely on their cell phones to communicate during an emergency, not their radios. Local leaders say this is just one example of how firefighters and police work around a fractured emergency communication system that needs some serious upgrades and maybe needs to be rethought altogether. Clatsop County has two emergency dispatch centers, one operated and staffed by the City of Astoria, the other by the City of Seaside. Since the mid-90s, there have been discussions about consolidating these centers into a single center. Those discussions ratcheted up in the early 2000s with a law that was soon rescinded that would have required consolidation. And following 2007's Great Coastal Gale, a massive coastal storm that exposed major vulnerabilities of the system. Over the years, there have been studies showing the potential benefits of consolidation, and local leaders were on board, but nothing happened. Then, just a few years ago, there were more reports, and the two dispatch centers even temporarily merged because of staffing shortages at Astoria Center. This brief combining of the centers further exposed deficiencies in technology and interoperability. But, just as important, it showed what consolidation might look like in practice.
It was a proof of concept.
That's Clatsop County Sheriff Matt Phillips. He says that around the same time, stakeholders, including fire and police chiefs, began to develop a governance document and looked at what would be involved if you combined the staff from the two existing dispatch centers. Yesterday, Phillips and County Manager Don Boone presented information and options to the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners with the aim of moving the process of consolidation forward. Boone and Phillips say there are multiple benefits to consolidating. It could address duplicated and fragmented infrastructure across the county, make it easier to deal with staffing shortages and to retain staff, and increase the reliability and speed of dispatch during emergency situations. But it's not easy. And Boone says all the stakeholders that use emergency dispatch services need to sign off and be supportive of any changes.
The whole process is premised on that, that we can't move forward without them. But it's also premised on the fact that if we're going to do something different, we have to do it in a way that actually moves the needle. Because, you know, rearranging what we're doing, if we can't really get to funding this at a level that for the next 30 years, the residents, the first responders can have confidence in the system, then I would argue probably status quo is probably as good as we can do. I think that the good news is there are options.
There are four options. Things could stay as they are. Governmental entities could sign a memorandum of understanding and create a new organization for emergency dispatch. Boone estimates that could be more costly than running two separate dispatch centers. Or they could create a service district. Unlike the Memorandum of Understanding route, this would be able to collect taxes, establishing a revenue stream to help fund operations and keep communications infrastructure in good working order. The option Boone and Phillips tend to favor is to form a county service district. Under this model, the county commissioners would be the district's governing body, and the district would be able to include a permanent rate, a property tax. Unlike the service district, the county service district would be able to plug into existing county infrastructure overhead, like human resources. Also, the county recently landed $1 million in federal funding that will be going to upgrading and replacing public safety communications equipment. If 911 dispatch consolidation is on the table, Phillips says those funds can be used in an even more targeted way. For now, consolidation is still just talk. Serious talk but talk. A meeting with city leaders and fire districts is planned for mid-March. Depending on what happens at that meeting, the county and its partners could finally be on a path toward consolidation. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
In 2024, the Jewell School District in Clatsop County was accused of doing little to stop a shop teacher's sexual abuse of a student. It has now been publicly disclosed that the district agreed to settle that federal lawsuit last May with a payment of $2.4 million. The lawsuit alleged that the district's administrators failed to intervene after receiving multiple complaints about teacher David Michael Brandon's suspected sexual assault of a seventh-grade female student. The suit also alleged that the district allowed Brandon to quietly resign and get a different teaching job with younger students at an elementary school in Clatsop County, despite multiple warnings that Brandon wasn't safe around students. On top of that, the lawsuit said the Jewell District hired Brandon with no experience as a shop teacher and no certification to teach a technical education class. Brandon, now 48, was arrested in 2021 in the case involving the seventh grader and convicted in 2023 in Clatsop County. He was sentenced to 3 months in jail. His probation was revoked shortly after for use of methamphetamine. Brandon was ordered to spend another 3 years in prison. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. Turning now to news across Oregon, Oregon lawmakers are advancing legislation that would set ground rules for automatic license plate reader technology. The Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously approved an amended version of the bill Monday. Senator Floyd Prezansky, a Democrat from Eugene, said the proposal does not have every detail he was hoping for, but it does include essential accountability measures.
This will, in fact, basically require agencies within the state to have some uniformity as to what they can or can't do in their contracts and the requirements for sharing that information with other entities, requiring that it be logged appropriately so it can be audited and checked. And I do think that this is a step in the right direction.
The bill would require law enforcement to delete vehicle data if it's not linked to a criminal investigation after 30 days, and data sharing would be limited to Oregon with specific exemptions. Oregon has released a final draft of an offshore wind energy roadmap. Jefferson Public Radio's Roman Battaglia reports the guide offers more alternatives than plans from other states.
The roadmap has been in the works since 2024. It'll give policymakers a guide for better positioning the state for offshore wind developments off the coast. The federal government tried to lease an area off the southern Oregon coast, but canceled it when most of the developers backed out. Jeff Burright has been spearheading the roadmap for the State Department of Land Conservation and Development. He says they began to change their expectations on this roadmap after meeting with coastal communities.
Through all of that conversation, what we learned is that there's not a clear and simple path to offshore wind right now.
Burright says the plan outlines actions for every possibility, including if the state chooses not to have any wind turbines off the coast at all. Public comment on this final draft of the roadmap is due in early April. Burright hopes to finalize and deliver it to lawmakers by this summer. I'm Roman Battaglia reporting.
Timber company Weyerhaeuser is switching most of the log trucks at its facility in Goshen off of diesel. KLCC's Zach Ziegler reports.
While this commercial truck sounds like it has a typical diesel engine, it's actually running on compressed natural gas. Weyerhaeuser's Gary Romine says the move puts the company in the vanguard.
And I think that's exciting. You'll be able to look back on that with pride and say, we actually took that chance and stepped out of our comfort zone.
The company has contracted Fixed Infrastructure to provide natural gas that's harvested from manure. Fix's Christian Cochran says that gas is methane that would otherwise go into the air.
That doesn't mean there's not any CO2 coming out the tailpipe, but when you go all the way through the process, it is shown to have a certified negative carbon intensity.
Weyerhaeuser will buy 10 natural gas-powered trucks a year for 5 years, and a company executive says the new trucks have shown enough promise that it may buy more after that. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting.
Avil Gordley died on Monday. As Lauren Dake reports, Gordley broke barriers as the first black woman elected to Oregon's state senate.
Gordley was a civil rights champion, an advocate for better mental health and education outcomes, and a pioneering politician who was remembered in the state senate this week as someone who led with compassion and who made a difference in the lives of many Oregonians. Senate Republican leader Bruce Starr called Gordley an Oregon legend. She worked to remove racist language from the state constitution. She was deeply connected to Portland, where she was born and raised. And as a person who grew up on North Williams Avenue and watched the displacement of Black Oregonians in the 1950s and 1970s, she always had a strong message for her colleagues in Salem.
That justice is not an abstract. It has faces and names, and neighborhoods.
Gordley died in her Portland home. She was 79. Lauren Dake, OPB.
Turning now to news from Washington, the state is submitting a $182 million claim to the Federal Emergency Management Agency for infrastructure damage from devastating floods that swept the region in December. Governor Bob Ferguson's latest request follows an application last month for $21.3 million in relief for individual households. The new claim would provide reimbursement for repairs to public buildings, parks, and water control facilities, including clearing debris. Ferguson says he hopes FEMA will approve the request, which would cover about three-quarters of the estimated damage.
This historic flooding resulted in, we believe, the largest dollar amount of public infrastructure damage in Washington State in more than four decades, and that's counting for inflation. So this is obviously a significant amount of money.
The state will also be seeking separate funding for mitigation measures like flood walls to protect against future storms. Some Washington legislators are reviving last year's attempt to lower the legal blood alcohol concentration limit for drivers. The idea has bipartisan support and opposition. Spokane Public Radio's Eliza Billingham reports.
The Washington Traffic Safety Commission supports dropping the BAC limit from 0.08% to 0.05%. For most adults, that would mean more than 3 to 4 standard drinks would make driving illegal. The commission hopes the rule would make more adults think twice before getting behind the wheel. It says that could reduce the number of people killed in alcohol-related accidents. Plus, it says a stricter deterrent would mean fewer arrests, which could in turn decrease the current strain on the state toxicology lab. Opponents doubt that. The idea died in the Senate last year. It narrowly passed this year, with Republicans and Democrats voting on either side. A House committee is scheduled to hear the proposal tomorrow. I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
Despite the efforts of some Democrats in Olympia, Washington's citizen initiative process won't change this year. As Owen Henderson reports, conservative advocates and the Democratic Secretary of State applaud the demise of Washington's so-called initiative killer bill.
The Democrats' proposal didn't pass a legislative deadline Tuesday. The bill would have banned per-signature payment for signature gatherers and added extra hurdles to file a measure. Supporters argue the current structure lets rich people put their pet interests in front of lawmakers or voters. Opponents, like conservative hedge fund manager and prolific initiative backer Brian Haywood, say the proposal was anti-democratic. Michael Cecil teaches constitutional law at Gonzaga University.
We want to create structures that allow direct democracy to take place, and also we want to create structures that push a legislature, irrespective of political party, to pursue policies that benefit the greater Washingtonians.
Democratic Secretary of State Steve Hobbs wrote in a statement, "Partisanship shouldn't distract from citizens' right to participate in direct democracy." Two of Haywood's ballot measures dealing with parental rights and transgender athletes are likely to go before voters this fall. I'm Owen Henderson, reporting.
Among the demands Democrats have made to end the partial federal government shutdown is that immigration agents start dressing more like law enforcement. As Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project, immigration operations now often have a paramilitary look.
It's a question people have had for months as they watched masked ICE and Border Patrol agents. Why are they decked out like that? The body armor, helmets, camouflage clothing. Camouflage obviously not designed for concealment on the streets of Minneapolis or in a home improvement store parking lot.
It's not your friendly neighborhood cop walking the beat, right? You know, it looks like they're dressed for an invasion. It looks like they are dressed for an occupation.
Charles McFarlane is a costume historian and journalist. He writes a Substack called Combat Threads that focuses on the intersection of pop culture and the military. He says ICE's getup isn't strictly about efficiently rounding up undocumented immigrants.
When you start to see uniforms less as completely utilitarian and more as trying to send messages both to an in-group and an out-group, it kind of unlocks a lot of things for people.
He says one thing their outfits are trying to convey is a sense of competence. Even though some agents trained only a few weeks, they're trying to look like the military's elite special operations troops. And he says another goal is to instill fear.
There is a kind of like menacing quality. You know, they're wearing body armor that's making them like 1.5 times bigger than they actually are. Like you're starting to actually break up your shape to like not even look like a human being anymore.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, didn't respond to queries about the uniforms and gear. Neither did Border Patrol or their parent agency, the Department of Homeland Security.
I'd be interested, you know, with the guys in the Special Forces community of like what they think of this gear being worn in this way.
Mr. McFarlane, meet Dan Barkoff, former Navy SEAL and Afghanistan combat vet.
You know, when I was 10 years old, I had a Patriots jersey, right? It's like, look at me, I'm a big leaguer now. I don't think you need to look like your Delta Force to arrest someone.
He says one sign the federal agents are at some level role-playing is the mismatch between their outfits and what they're doing.
Those guys are dressed like they're going on a CQB mission.
CQB is close quarters battle, high intensity fighting, often indoors.
They are not dressed, even like they're doing a foot patrol. They're not dressed for land warfare. They're dressed for, you know, going into a house and shooting someone.
Many are wearing vests with heavy plates that can stop rifle bullets, but make it hard to chase someone.
It doesn't make any sense, right? Like you want to go and round up a bunch of Nicaraguan day laborers, right? Well, you'd want to be able to run, you know, right? And chase people.
He says the uniforms and gear can contribute to aggressive attitudes and an us versus them mindset.
When I got kitted up and got in a Humvee, I felt damn near as invincible as it's possible to feel. And we all felt that, right? Like there's this tribal, like we're invincible, no one can stop us. Which, again, it's useful in a combat environment. It's nothing useful in a policing environment.
Meanwhile, others who typically wear military uniforms are taking steps to prevent being mistaken for immigration agents. When the Minnesota National Guard was activated to support local law enforcement, they wore brightly colored reflective vests. Simon Schaefer, a deputy state adjutant general, says the vests are both for safety and traffic and to distinguish the National Guard from other agencies.
You know, we are representing the communities that we live in, that we work in. And so being more visible, and it's the safety of our members, but also it shows the public that the National Guard is present and contributing.
McFarlane, the costume historian, notes the high-end military look has become omnipresent in popular culture, from movies and gaming to everyday clothing. Lately, though, he says he's heard more people mocking the agents' outfits, perhaps eroding the appeal of dressing like special operations. I'm Jay Price, reporting.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchen, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.